evening, welcome to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'm Padraig Reedy, and I'll hand over to Neil Denny to introduce this week's guest.
Thanks, Padraig. We're very pleased to be welcoming back Ben Goldacre, who's on the show nearly 3 years ago. Ben Goldacre is a writer, broadcaster and a medical doctor from the UK who is best known for his Bad Science column in The Guardian, examining the claims of scaremongering journalists, quack health products, pseudoscientific cosmetics adverts and evil multinational pharmaceutical corporations. Well, that's a bit of a mouthful. As well as wider themes such as the medicalisation of everyday life and the psychology of irrational beliefs. Ben works full-time for the NHS, appears regularly on radio and TV, and has written for publications as diverse as Time Out, the British Medical Journal, New Statesman and The Lancet, as well as writing and presenting programmes for BBC Radio 4, The Rise of Lifestyle Nutritionists and The Power of the Placebo. Ben's first book, Bad Science, was published this September by Fourth Estate. Ben, thanks for coming back.
Hey, hi.
So tell us why you decided to write the book, I suppose, is the first thing we should start with.
Well, it sort of felt like there was a bit of a gap in the ideas market for somebody to talk about just the basic science of how we know if something's good for us, will sort of, you know, help treat diseases, or if it's bad for us and will do us harm. Basically, a popular science book about evidence-based medicine. And there's obviously a huge desire for this kind of thing, because if you look at, you know, the Daily Mail, for example, has this bizarre ongoing philosophical project of dividing all the inanimate objects in the world, really, into the ones that either cause or cure cancer. So there's this passion. People want to know about these things, biblical themes like death and pain, but we don't have the basics to understand it. We don't know the basics of evidence-based medicine. There's never been an exhibit on evidence-based medicine at a science museum. We're not taught it at schools. And the people who tell us about this stuff, which are mainly kind of miracle cure peddlers and journalists, repeatedly, as I demonstrate, get stuff just flat wrong.
So, I mean, really, dead simply then, what does that mean, evidence-based medicine?
Evidence-based medicine is the science of how you know if something is good for you or bad for you. And I start off in the book by using lots of very simple examples, like things like, you know, homeopathy or sort of obvious scare stories, mainly because they make really simple and easy teaching examples. So I teach sort of medical students and doctors a course where it's actually called Drug Company Bullshit on the UCL timetable. I was moved to see, but elsewhere it's called things like critically appraising clinical trial methodology. And spotting the blags that drug companies do on doctors is a very difficult and sort of elegant art, because they can't bluff you by rubbishing you in the way that you know, quack columnists in Sunday glossy magazines do. But they're all part of the same tradition, and the tricks of the trade from the $50 billion food supplement pill industry and the $600 billion pharmaceutical industry are really sort of one and the same. It's just a matter of complexity. So if there is a narrative arc to the book, it is basically sort of starting off with the more straightforward examples of people getting things wrong because they make good teaching tools, and then moving on to Big Pharma.
So, we're going to look at that perhaps in a bit more detail a bit later, but perhaps we should then begin by looking at the meat of the issue. What should we do, right? I've just now scribbled on the back of this piece of paper a new idea for a drug. What should I do? How should I design a test that's transparent and ethical and all the rest? What should we do?
Well, if you want to know if something works or not, well, first of all, you've got to decide what do you think it's going to do? Like, what are you claiming it's going to do? So if you're saying that it will, you know, if you're saying this is an arthritis drug, then the first thing you've got to do is decide, well, what actually matters with an arthritis drug? And interestingly, doctors and academics often have very different ideas about what matters to the ideas that patients have. And really, it's bizarre that it's only been in the last 10 years that people have bothered to ask patients what they think is important. So when you ask arthritis patients what's important to them, they say completely different things to what doctors and academics actually do. They don't say, we'd like you to research lots and lots of different non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that might compete with each other in the marketplace for who can be best at reducing pain. They say things like, well, we'd be interested if you could look at the value of physiotherapy or other everyday sort of coping strategies. When you talk to people about Alzheimer's, they don't say, we want you to research these pills. They say, we'd like to know what the long-term benefits of respite care and occupational therapy might be. So the first question might be, does anybody actually want your new pill at all? does it address a problem that anybody's interested in? The second thing that you have to do, which academics have also always traditionally been very bad at, is you should survey the literature to see what's already known about a given pill before you do a new experiment. And actually, there's this organisation called the Cochrane Collaboration, which is a non-profit international collaboration of academics who really just sort of bring together evidence from trials from all around the world and put them all into one big spreadsheet, effectively, to get the one big answer. And they found, looking back, sort of through the retrospectoscope, that actually, in a lot of situations, people had done, say, 30 trials on whether antibiotics were good for preventing people from getting an infection just after having a liver operation. And we knew that they were effective after 20 trials, but people continued to do another 10. So the next thing you'd want to do, God, this is turning into a riot medical student lecture, isn't it? Sorry about that. The next thing you do is make sure that you know what people already know before you even think about doing a piece of research, to make sure that it's not a pointless piece of research. Then you've decided that you want to know if your pill is useful. So then you've got to decide what it's better than. And I suppose most people would say, well, you want to do a placebo-controlled trial. So you want to compare your drug against a placebo sugar pill. So you take 200 people, split them into two groups, 100 people in each group, and then you give half of them your treatment and you give the other half your placebo sugar pill, which is indistinguishable, so nobody knows which they're getting, and then you measure who's got better by whatever criteria you set in the first place. But actually, that's not true. You don't want to do a placebo-controlled trial because it's probably unethical to do a placebo-controlled trial in a lot of situations. A placebo won't really do anything. I mean, it'd be great if we could talk about the placebo because it's unbelievably fascinating, but it's unethical to do a placebo-controlled trial if there's already a treatment that exists that is quite good for the condition that you're talking
about.
Because
basically you're denying half of the people in the trial.
Exactly.
An existing.
Now, that's certainly not the case if you don't know if your treatment is effective and if there is no other effective treatment. That argument doesn't hold. But if there's an existing effective treatment, then you must, you should do a comparison where you give two different treatments and you give those in a way that's sort of as indistinguishable as possible.
So, well, before we get to the slightly more mendacious side of not carrying out this method correctly, let's look at some of the more obvious ways in which, I don't know, people could innocently fail to carry out a test in this thing. And if we can talk about a concrete example, I'd like you to talk about the Durham fish oil trials.
Oh, well, that's a really interesting one. So the Durham fish oil pill story is basically, there was this huge string of newspaper reports that were coming out saying, fish oil pills improve school performance and behaviour in children. And this was about 2 years ago. And I went and went to the council and said, you've been saying you're doing this big trial. Can you tell me what you're planning on doing? Because it looks a bit to me as if you're just getting 3,000 kids and giving them all fish oil pills. And then you're going to measure their GCSE performance and compare that against what you think they were going to get in their GCSEs, and then that's going to be your measure of whether these pills are effective or not. And it strikes me that that's a pretty stupid way of doing an experiment. You yourself could come up with a very good reason of why children might do better if they're all being given these fish oil pills.
Well, also, if people are just watching them as well, if somebody's saying to them, well, we're going to be testing you and you're under a spotlight, people are going to behave, aren't they, for a start?
Yeah, so I mean, really, you're kind of talking about the placebo effect writ large, aren't you? Expectations are very high, the nation is watching, because this was, fascinatingly, the most well-reported clinical trial, I would say, of the last few years. I can't think of a single clinical trial that's had as much attention in the media as these fish oil pills. Actually, that's a really interesting thing in itself. So in 2006, at exactly the same time that this fish oil pill thing was kicking off, there was a paper published in the British Medical Journal, which is probably the most influential medical journal in Britain. And it was about this amazing miracle intervention that really did improve school performance and behaviour in children, and it was accompanied by a compelling cost-effectiveness analysis. So there was gold standard evidence from a well-performed clinical trial with a cost-effectiveness analysis published in a proper journal showing that one miracle cure intervention improved school performance and behaviour, but it was completely ignored. And that's because it was a parenting programme. And a parenting programme, it's not news, whereas the fish oil pill, firstly, it's kind of transgressive because it's, you know, pill solves complex social problem, which is a really attractive idea, I think, to everyone. But secondly, also, the parenting program isn't going to get promoted by some press agency on behalf of food supplement pill manufacturing company, and it's not going to get pushed by a local council who are promoting one, you know, civil servant's vanity project.
Do you think, just getting back to the point about parenting programs versus fish oils, it seems to me that we have a simultaneous, very differing views to science and medical science. That on the one hand, we expect medical science to solve everything, but on the one hand, we are very, very, I suppose cynical is probably the wrong word, scared really, of, you know, there's the Frankenstein scenario and there's also the Brave New World scenario simultaneously playing out in our heads. How can you kind of make it clear to people what medical science can and cannot do?
It's really interesting, isn't it, that people have these really conflicting mythologies about what they expect from science and medicine. I think there's a whole lot of stuff that's happened in the last 50 years that's made it much more difficult for people to talk about science and medicine, partly because technology's got much more complicated. So in 50 years ago, when our parents were at school, you could understand every component in your car and repair it. You could understand exactly how an AM radio worked from start to finish. It was completely straightforward. You could build a crystal radio set at school that was exactly the same as the one you'd buy in the shop. Now, technology has got so far ahead of popular understanding that I think we'd all struggle to concoct a satisfactory explanation of how this mobile phone worked or you know, how this mixing desk operates. And I think there's something very intellectually threatening about that. It's occult. It's quite sinister. And I think that makes people nervous because there's all this stuff around them that they're using all the time, but which is intellectually impenetrable. And that must be very, very frightening. I think also people have this sort of... people want certainty. And particularly from medicine, they want certainty. And it's interesting that if you look at the kind of the recent history of medicine, things have kind of... The pattern of development in academic medicine has really changed over the last 50 years. Before the 1930s, as a profession, we were basically useless. We had morphine, which is a drug with sort of superficial charm, and we had insulin, I suppose, and we could do operations quite cleanly, but needed very high doses of anaesthetics because we didn't have muscle-blocking drugs. Then, between the 1930s and 1970s, there was this genuine barrage of miracle cures and sinister hidden scares. Antibiotics, you know, intensive care units were invented, cardiopulmonary resuscitation, the thing where you bounce up and down on someone's chest and they come back to life, which doesn't really work in real world, but works on TV dramas.
Oh dear.
And also at the same time, we were discovering these one-to-one relationships between environmental exposures and diseases. So, you know, tobacco turned out to cause 95% of lung cancer. To everybody's surprise, actually. I mean, they thought it was going to be something like tarmac or something that had happened during the war. So there really was this period of sort of miracle cures and hidden scares. But since then, the pattern of innovation in academic medicine has changed. You don't get these sudden epoch-making breakthroughs. What you get is the gradual accrual of very modest changes in our understanding of the risks and benefits of different interventions and different risk exposures. So your chances of dying as a middle-aged man overall over the past 30 years have roughly halved, but that's not because of any individual, amazing, transgressive epoch-making breakthrough. And I think that's something that's been very difficult for popular culture and in particular journalists to cope with, because they still try and crowbar these very modest changes in risk into their pre-existing miracle cure, hidden scare template for stories. But it's also been quite difficult for the pharmaceutical industry because they've got fewer and fewer new drugs coming online. So that the number of novel molecular compounds being invented, being registered, even 10 years ago was around 50 a year. And now that's down to 20. So that presents quite an interesting commercial problem for them. I mean, the story kind of, I think, has to go, you know, because they can't invent any new treatments for the diseases we already have. Instead, they've had to invent new diseases for the treatments they already have. And that has been a really fascinating cultural process to watch.
Well, this is something that we've often talked about on this show, is something that the alternative medicine industry does as well. So I think this, it's good and interesting in the, I suppose, as some sort of balance that we should perhaps have a good look at how Big Pharma does the same thing. So let's talk about this. Let's talk about this idea of the medicalisation of everyday complaints. What sort of things do you mean?
I suppose the obvious candidates would be things like female sexual dysfunction as a new way of selling Viagra to the 50% of the population who are unfortunate enough not to have a penis, or social anxiety disorder, or restless leg syndrome, or night eating syndrome, another opportunity to sell SSRI, antidepressant drugs. And all of these are problems in themselves. I mean, you know, shyness can be crippling, but the question is more whether the biomedical sort of reductionist, science-y, explanatory model is the most appropriate way to address a problem like that. And also, you know, what does it say about us that that's such an attractive way of thinking them through? So to my mind, it's not so much that people are selling the pill as the solution. It's almost more interesting that people are selling the reductionist biomedical explanation. If you look at the period around which female sexual dysfunction was first being sold in the media, the standard story in a kind of glossy woman's magazine would be it would be illustrated with, you know, a man and a woman lying in bed, and she would have his back to him, and his, you know, erection would be poking into her back, and they'd both be looking miserable, which is officially the most depressing image imaginable to mankind. And the first paragraph of the story would be, you know, they went to the doctor and they weren't having sex anymore, and the GP was completely useless, because that's the first paragraph of any medical story, really. And then they went to a specialist, and they were useless too. And then they went to this private clinic, and in this private clinic, they understood. They took blood tests. They did 24-hour blood hormone profiling. They did imaging. They did clitoral blood flow imaging. And they found that there was a mechanical cause for why they weren't having sex anymore. And it's almost as if that was more important than the fact that the pill was the solution, because we don't want to talk about the fact that, you know, maybe he's being bullied at work and is finding it difficult coming to terms with the fact that she's now the mother of his three children and no longer the sex vixen that he first snogged on the floor of the student union bar in 1983 to the sound of Don't You Want Me Baby by the Human League, because instead it was all about impaired clitoral blood flow and testosterone levels in blood hormone profiles. And I think that's what's kind of happening with the fish oil pills will make your child a genius stories as well. You know, it's like we don't want to talk about the fact that Durham, where this bogus experiment was being performed on thousands of children incompetently. We don't want to talk about the fact that probably the biggest predictor of inequalities in outcome in education is social class. We'd much rather pretend that it's about molecules in your nervous system. And in exactly the same way, you know, the rise of the nutritionists has been really fascinating, because to my mind, this idea that food, and particularly very specific individual types of food or very specific molecules, are the most important lifestyle risk factor for ill health, is in itself a very political and actually quite bogus project. The biggest predictor of life of health outcome inequality, again, is social class. Where I lived in Kentish Town, predominantly white working class area, and adult male life expectancy there is about 70. Dr. Gillian McKeith, PhD, or to give her full medical title, Gillian McKeith. She lives in a big witchy castle made of money in Hampstead. And adult male life expectancy in Hampstead is 80. And the difference between those two areas of 10 years, which is a huge difference, isn't because the people in Hampstead are careful to eat a handful of goji berries every day so that they get a diet rich in antioxidants, as per, you know, Gillian McKeith's lifestyle advice. And it's not because they're careful to eat a handful of Brazil nuts every day to make sure they're not deficient in selenium. It's because of a whole complex nexus of complex interlocking social and political issues involving, you know, work exposure, social support, stability, and all of that stuff. And actually, to profess to people that these commodifiable lifestyle interventions, because that's always those, it's never walking school buses or cycle paths, it's always, you know, cherry juice, something that a press agency can put something out about. To pretend that diet is the biggest lifestyle risk factor for ill health is, to my mind, it's a very right-wing individualist manifesto. It's the deserving sick in the way that people used to talk about the deserving poor. And it's become so commonplace. I mean, I actually find it quite offensive. You know, I'm sure you've heard it yourself. You'll sort of be chatting to somebody and they'll say, oh, well, I have to walk past this council estate every day on the way to the tube. And, you know, you can say what you like, but I think it's got to be diet. You see some of these people and they're feeding their kids crisps for breakfast and they're only three, and it's got to be diet, hasn't it? And you go, well, Yeah, diet might be part of it, but I think there are probably, you know, I think you'll find it's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, you can sort of carry this a bit further in a way that's, I don't know, slightly depressing to talk about, really, because this is entirely laudable. Just this week, Jamie Oliver's got a new series on, which, you know, the very idea is he's gone to Rotherham and he's going to change the diet of the people, and therefore it's going to, you know, have a knock-on effect that's massively going to improve their lives. And, you know, Jamie's great. He did wonder. He's done wonderful things to highlight the issues around school dinners and stuff. He's in no way a pseudoscientific or a quack or anything. And yet it's not going to work, is it? I mean, clearly this is a thing
diet is a lifestyle risk factor for ill health. And, you know, it's possible that changing people's diet will change long-term health outcomes, although the evidence for that, when people have done big trials looking at it, has all been negative so far. But it's possible, you know, a diet rich in fresh fruit and veg is also probably going to have less sugar in it. It's going to have less energy per mouthful, so maybe less obesity in the long run. So, and also, you know, if you change the way that a family cooks, then that could conceivably change the way that family relates to each other, because you're coming together and, you know, maybe more as a family, or eating more together or something, rather than putting microwave meals in individually. But I think it's very interesting that, I mean, Jamie Oliver is a sort of perfect example of how, after the sort of death of big ideas in politics, what you instead have is, you know, he seems like a perfectly all right bloke to me, and he, you know, he's doing the right kind of stuff, but you have a celebrity TV chef addressing issues of employment opportunities in the workplace by opening up a restaurant. And even its name, what was it called? 15 or something? Because it employed 15 people. Even that sort of spoke, really, to the kind of, the almost emblematic sort of drop in the oceanness of the whole project. You know, it was like 15, as in, like, great, 15 people, you know. I think we've lost our ability to talk about the more important big political issues, and instead it all has to come through either celebrity or these sort of slightly bogus surrogate vehicles like diet, because we can't talk about the more important issues.
But we get back then to the 15 thing, in a sense, is relates back to something that it's small and it's local, and I'm making a small little difference, which is the same as I'm eating my goji berries, therefore I'm a good person.
Yeah, it's quite narcissistic, isn't it? And it's very individualistic. And actually, all of the evidence shows that public health interventions that have an effect on the health of a whole population are things that you do and that you change at a whole population. You know, you change what's in the supermarkets, people eat what's available to them easily, and people behave in ways that are sort of easy for them to behave. So if you make London a really hostile environment to cycle in, then people won't cycle in it. If you have stupid cycle paths, some of which I could show you photographs are shorter than the length of a bicycle, if you put bicycle paths right next to a set of parked cars, so that if you cycled in it, then every time somebody opened a door, you would just die. But if you cycle outside it, then all the cars on the road get really indignant and beep their horns because they think that you should be in the little green cycle path lane. If you do all of that, people will cycle less and people will be less healthy in your capital. Whereas, if you do things that make exercise something that can be integrated naturally into people's everyday lives, then people will become healthier. But fascinatingly, all over the country, there will be people who are working as public health professionals who will be sending out press releases saying, oh, we're trying to get a walking school bus scheme together locally, so that, you know, people don't have to drive their children into obesity by driving them to school. And they'll maybe use a little pun like that and feel really pleased with themselves. But they'll be ignored, and local papers won't cover it, and national papers won't cover it, because they want the goji berry. They want the handful of Brazil nuts contains selenium. They want the glamorous, easy, quick fix, and people don't want to talk about the much more, the much realer, but also free things that you can do to.
Well, that's. I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, but then people can make money out of goji berries. They can't necessarily make money out of the walking school bus, can they?
Yeah, but it's only the death of good journalism that has meant that basically all hacks do now, given, you know, a situation where they're producing three times as much newsprint in these enormous newspapers, which you throw most of them away, with smaller staff, so that each journalist is generating more and more words, and all they do is rewrite press releases, you know. I mean, if you want to get something in the news these days, Jesus, I mean, it's practically a plagiarism issue. There's a chap called Martin Moore, actually, who you should totally get in, Media Standards Trust, and a very, very, very good organisation. But we're doing a project using that plagiarism software that they use in academia, just to compare, like, a day's output of newspapers against the preceding few days' worth of press releases, just to see how much is just genuinely just completely lifted from press releases. And you find it time and time again, you know.
Well, we're out of time, and there's so much we haven't discussed. It's not true, so we'll perhaps have to do this in another time. Ben, thank you very much for coming on again.
Cheers, pleasure.